I am going to talk on early user space, which is a new concept we're introducing, or actually have introduced in Resource of Linux. This has been a collaborative effort, and I can't even claim credit for being the one that started the momentum on it, but hey, I pitched in. In very, very early versions of Linux, the root file system was mounted directly by the kernel, and you had to actually go in and edit your kernel binary to patch in the device number that where it was going to find the root device. Eventually, someone thought that, well, this sucks, and I'm going to write a tool to patch my kernel binary for me. Well, this sort of worked, but quite frankly, this isn't really the most friendly sort of thing. So, somewhere about a year later, we came up with this perfectly brilliant little idea called the kernel command line. And as part of that, we allowed the root device to be set manually. You didn't no longer had to patch your kernel binary. First, you had to do this by device number, and eventually, people thought that, well, this is kind of annoying. I don't refer to my hard drive by device number usually, so let's do it by name. There's just a slight problem with this. The kernel isn't the part of the system that's responsible for resolving device names. This is done by the dev directory that's on the file system. Unfortunately, we haven't mounted the file system yet. So there is, in the kernel, a table of common device names that's used only for this purpose. Time goes and someone says, hey, I want my root file system to be on NFS. Well, fine, the kernel has everything it needs to mount NFS. However, it doesn't have things that it normally would need to get on the network. It's very hard to mount NFS if you're not on the network. So, now we need to put in things like RARP, BootP, DHCP, there's actually an RPC interaction that goes on with the mount daemon that would normally be done by the mount binary. All this needs to go into the kernel now. And it's only used when you're mounting the root file system NFS. It is removed once it's done. So it's not actually wasted memory, but it's kernel code. It has to be written using kernel coding rules, and it's only used for a single purpose. Yes. Yes, that is correct, because you don't have the locking daemon running, so you have to do it without locking. This is usually not a problem, because in most people that mount their root file system NFS actually mount it read-only. And if you're not mounting it read-only, that's usually because you have a separate root file system prepared for each client, in which case you only care about local locking. So this kind of, as this is increasingly spinning out of control, we kind of figure out that we have to do something to kind of avoid this avalanche of complexity. So we come up with a mechanism called initrd to load a piece of user space code before the quote-unquote real root has been mounted. Unfortunately, some of the implementations here were kind of hacky. In particular, the way you get it to mount the quote-unquote real root is, again, specifying a device number. This is not really that useful if you want, for example, an NFS file system to be your root file system. Or SMB or TempFS. I actually have written myself a system that uses TempFS as root. But worse, this isn't really caused by initrd, but the initrd code makes this almost impossible to get rid of. The randis code itself is like a rash all over several portions of the VM area. It simply introduces special cases because things that would normally be cached are now essential, only copy of certain data. And we haven't really found a good solution to deal with that. And the other thing is building a file system, you know, like an ext2 file system or a DOS file system or something like that on the fly is actually relatively painful. And that's because, you know, it has to be done as root. You have to rewrite a whole special set of tools to do this. File system structures are complex, which means that, for example, you can't expect a bootloader to be able to synthesize one of these images, or modify, or even worse, modify one of these images. It's way too much code. So, well, a couple of years go by and we finally come up with a solution to deal with the problem on having to specify the real root by device number. We come up with a system called pivotroot, which takes takes the root file system and another file system and goes like that. Well, now we get into some of the kernel internals that deal with this. In Unix, each process has a root. You know, there's a system called chroot that you can use to change it. And each process has a current working directory. In Linux, a kernel thread is just a process that doesn't happen to have any pages associated with it, which means that it has a root directory and a current working directory. Well, what directories are you going to pick for a kernel thread? Well, the only one that you know is going to be around is going to be root. So you use the root. Well, now when we can do this, well, typically what you want to do is you want to take your RAM disk here and unmount it. Suddenly, the root of your kernel threads all disappeared. This is a little bit annoying. So, what we do? Well, we hack pivotroot so that it goes through all the processes and messes with their root files, or messes with their root and current working directory in such a way that they're now on the real root. This is ugly. We don't like special cases. Special cases cause things to slow down, to break, to do all kinds of things that we don't like. Most importantly, they don't get tested well. Because you don't do your development Well, I'm sure there are some people that do, but most people don't do their development by booting their system 400,000 times. Most system people actually try to do some real work in between. So, special cases that are only used during boot are bad. Kernel code is messy to write. If you attended Rusty's writing kernel code tutorial, then you know all about that. You have things like limitations on memory management. Things don't work as you normally expect them. You don't have library functions that you're normally used to. And your mistakes stick around forever. If you don't free your data structures, you are hogging that memory until the machine is shut down. It's hard to futz with this code, because like the DHCP server, for example. I maintain a bootloader, and I keep getting questions. Probably like a third of the questions we get on the Syslinux mailing list are actually kernel questions. How do I do this with the kernel? And it's usually because they're trying to do something that the NFS root people didn't expect or something like that. And typically, when you tell them, in order to do that, you have to do an initrd and you have to do all these things by hand, and you need glibc on it too, and they get all messy. And we don't want problems like the pivot root issue where your kernel threads have to be treated specially by this one system call. So, in 2.4.11, Al Vero wrote this thing called rootfs, which was based on ramfs, and it simply says, instead of introducing this special concept of a process with no root, let's just create a root for it. That isn't the real root, that isn't on a disk. It's just an inode hanging in hyperspace. What's an inode? It's just a data structure. We can create a data structure and have pointers pointing to it. No big deal. Well, it's a ramfs, because Linus had already written this, like how to write a really simple file system demo and call it ramfs. Well, if we use it every time we boot, it's now mandatory. You can't compile it out anymore. Who cares? It's not a whole lot of code. And it actually turns out to be a really nice collection of routines that we can use for all kinds of virtual file systems. In 2.5, this is actually factored out into something called libfs. I've written up here that procfs could use it, and yes, it could. It doesn't right now, and it's really unfortunate. But we like it eventually to do it. So one of the things that this does is it actually lets it gets rid of a whole bunch of special cases, not the least because we get to have a root really, really early. The only thing we really need to initialize is the virtual memory layer. Once that's done, we have basically a complete user space. We don't have a lot of the special cases that are called, but root is not mounted yet. Because we have a root. Its root is empty. It's not useful for anything. But we no longer have to worry about this, that being a special case. Once we know what the quote real root should be, we just mount it on top. So the original root is still there. It's no longer accessible. But who cares? It's empty. Kernel threads can still use it as their root, which means that any manipulations you do of the namespace no longer apply. It doesn't apply to them. So that special case goes away. Well, if we have user space early, let's use it. We have all this like special case initialization code. Let's push it out to user space. In 2.4, again, Alvira took a lot of this initialization code and changed it from using kernel internals to actually calling system calls from kernel space. You know, instead of invoking like the VFS read method directly, he just calls the read system call. But it's all still done from kernel space, and you still have to deal with kernel programming. So 2.5, I want to take this a step further. Let's get rid of initrd so that we can stop worrying about the RAM disk code causing problems everywhere. Let's instead use a very simple piece of code. This happens to be a CPIO extractor to populate the rootfs. Why CPIO? And I mean, why CPIO? Not why CPIO was supposed to tar, as more like why CPIO was supposed to an ext2 file system image. Well, the code to create one is a lot simpler, and the code to decode one is a lot simpler. We don't want to use the ext2fs code that's normally running, that normally accesses things from disks, because it means we need to simulate a disk, and that's what's causing all these problems. Instead, just a very simple piece of code that just knows how to read a CPIO archive, extracts these files, and now we have an actual file system in user space. You know, never mind the fact that we haven't even, you know, loaded any drivers yet. Because it's a CPIO archive, and we actually made some slight modifications to the CPIO specification, which they were all in the direction of being more liberal. So you can always take a genuine CPIO file and it will be decoded, but You can play some cheats. Those cheats allow, for example, a bootloader to synthesize one of these files. Say that you have a very smart bootloader who knows how to go out on your PCI bus and look at all the device numbers. And it says, oh, well, I'm gonna need this module to talk to my SCSI card. I'm gonna need this module to talk to my network card, and it can actually put them in a customized initramfs. Another reason is that some bootloaders produce information about the boot that could be relevant to the kernel later, and it could just create a CPIO image and make them available to the boot by just putting them in a file. If we want to remove a lot of this code from the kernel, like the DHCP client, we pretty much need this to build as part of the kernel build. Otherwise, we have heard time and time again that simply people will not accept it. People want their existing environment to work going from 2.4 to 2.6. That's fair, it's a fair request. But so fine, you know, we can build a CPIO image as part of the kernel build and still have it do the same thing. Now, if we're gonna do all the stuff in user space, we don't want to use glibc. glibc is significantly bigger than the kernel. That's because glibc does everything. I am sorry, I do not care about Swahili localization in my RAMFS. It comes every couple of years, someone comes on the Linux kernel mailing list and asks if we can localize the kernel. Why? What? I have no idea, and quite frankly, I don't care. I think that message has actually been removed completely, but... bottom line is, kernel messages are really for debugging. We don't really want to have these huge message databases in the kernel. We don't want to have them in InterRMFS either. We want a really, really lightweight layer on top of the kernel system calls. And that is what glibc is. glibc is about 19 kilobytes on i386. It's pretty much as lightweight as you can get and still get something that looks like normal C. It can be shared among multiple programs, so you don't have to worry about like busyboxing things, you know, put everything into a single huge binary. So you can use normal Unix-like, you know, one program does one thing and kind of techniques. That's, glibc is a very thin layer upon, you know, it's a very thin layer on Linux kernel system calls. Could you reuse it? Sure. You probably would need a lot more porting work than you would need to port dietlibc, uclibc, or newlib. Simply because it is so, it is very much special purpose. And it's not really designed to support more than one embedded to support embedded platforms underneath it. That being said, there's probably useful code in there. If you want to write like a libc subset for something like a bootloader or something like that, probably one of the first things you're going to do is you're going to look for reusable printf code. By all means. glibc hopefully will be released under the BSD type license, just so people can do that. There's still a few issues relating to the use of kernel headers. That means that I can't really say that it's BSD clean yet. because in a few places I've had to, there, some of the kernel headers have been so broken that I've had to go in and cut, paste, and edit code. And I need to actually merge those changes back into the kernel headers so I can remove them from kalibc before that. The rest of the code should be fine. So again, the initramfs, one or more CPIO archives that may or may not be compressed using gzip, and they get expanded onto the rootfs. The protocol is designed to be as simple as possible. It's probably like maybe 50 to 100 lines of assembly to create a file. As the example I already mentioned, one of the bootloaders I maintain boots off the network. It gets DHCP packets. There are some weird environments where if you do a DHCP query again, you get a different IP address. And the administrators of these systems really don't want to have to ask the DHCP server again, because they will get a different answer. Don't ask me how these systems work. So they want all these DHCP packets to be saved away and available to the kernel so that the kernel can configure, or actually to user space, to the operating system, so that they can configure their IP based on the original DHCP query as opposed to doing another DHCP query. How do you save it away? Well, putting it in a file is a nice and convenient way to do it. That's exactly right, which is why we have slightly modified the the CPIO specification is exactly so you can, because real CPIO, you have to kind of look for this trailer and kind of stuff. So we said, well, the trailer is optional and we're gonna ignore it anyway. And we allow a compressed archive to be concatenated with a non-compressed archive and a few things like that. An open question at this point is, do we really want this to be the rootfs? Or do we want to take another ramfs and mount it on top of the rootfs so that when we unmount it, all these files go away? The rootfs obviously can never be unmounted. It's the root. Well, so we have a programming environment. Now how do we write code for it? Well, it's user space. A lot of the rules that you have to worry about in the kernel don't apply. Malloc works. You can put large stuff on your stack without worrying about overflowing the kernel stack. If you're being particularly nasty, you can exit. All your resources get freed up. Files, sockets, anything you want. You can even get binsh. Believe me, there have been people already asking for it. But you want to keep things small. We don't want the initramfs to be three times the size of the kernel. I mean, there's probably people who have really weird environments who have a need for 20 megabytes in initramfs. I got a bug report recently for someone who complained that they couldn't have an initrd bigger than 128 megabytes compressed. Kid you not. I fixed that bug. But if you're going to write code that's going to be used by most people in an InterMFS, please keep it small. Before you throw in all kind of random features, make them optional. Don't require a whole tree of configuration files in order to operate. Try to keep your programs as self-consistent as possible, because you will frequently see people going, oh, I need that thing, and I need that thing. And just try to minimize the number of binaries and just in general files they need. Line-oriented STDIO, in particular fgets, is very, very slow. And the reason for that is because kalibc doesn't do any buffering at all. If you don't do any buffering, the only way you can get, you can find the end of line character and leave the file pointer in the right place, especially if you're getting input from a device, is to read one character at a time. Yes, it calls read once for every character. Does this matter? Probably not. But I really, really want to see a good reason before I start implementing buffering in kalibc, and I probably won't. So just don't overuse it. You can write code that compiles both for kalibc and for normal user space. If you want to test whether or not you're compiling for kalibc, underscore, underscore, kalibc, underscore, underscore. Pretty standard. Now, so what kind of stuff are we talking about moving to user space? Partitioning code. All the partition code is actually not, device mapping. All partition code really is pretty much the kernel going, here, this is a disk. Please be so kind and tell me which parts of it are which device, so it can tell you what's your HDA1 and what's your HDA2 and what's your HDA3. Does this have to be done by the kernel? No, it doesn't. All you need to be able to do is to open the main device and have an interface for the kernel to say, oh, this this chunk here is one file system, and this chunk here is one file system, and these two things are a RAID group and should be one file system. Oh, this is a logical volume, and these 47 chunks constitute a volume group. This could all be done in user space. Detecting the root file system type. The kernel has to be spoon-fed with a type of file system that you're trying to mount for everything except the root file system. For the root file system, it will go and try to guess it by itself. It could all be done in user space. Well, NFS root, this is probably the most glaring candidate for moving to user space. We don't need a RARP, a BOOTP, and a DHCP client in the kernel. We don't need RPC code to talk to mount D in the kernel. Something that we've talked about a bit is to replace or change the way the kernel command line is handled. Partly because the kernel command line, quite frankly, is too small. It's limited to 255 characters on most platforms, and you really can't get a complete set of configuration information on a lot of platforms these days with that much space. It's also different from the way modules handle things, so suddenly you have to configure things one way if it's compiled into the kernel and another way if it's compiled as a module. This isn't really good. So, where are we at? Some of this is a little bit, some of this is already done, some of this is still pie in the sky. InitRAMFS, already done. Hasn't been tested much because the infrastructure to use it isn't there. It, you know, every time we test it, it seems to be okay, but until lots of people use it, there may be bugs. Caleb C, pretty much done. Every now and then I get email from people saying, oh, well, we need this function. Like recently we need system in Caleb C. That was for mod utils. I asked them why the heck they needed it. We kind of agreed that maybe it would be better to just remove some functionality from mod utils. We don't need it to be quite so fancy in when you compile it for Caleb C. It's not yet ported to some of the more rarely used architectures, and this is largely because I haven't gotten any response back from the architecture maintainers. All the architectures which I have a contact for the maintainer, except PA-RISC, works. PA-RISC doesn't work because the architecture maintainer wrote me back and said, I don't want to do any work for you.
Correction, the architecture maintainer said, I don't want to work on BXP code. I want GPL or LGPL code.
Right. Stand corrected. Unfortunately, I don't want to change the license for all of Caleb C for that reason. And it will eventually sort itself out, I figure. The amount of architecture specific code for most architectures in Caleb C is very small. It's perhaps, you know, 20 lines of assembly or so. Some architectures, however, don't follow that pattern. In particular, the Spark and Alpha architectures requires a fairly large support library that isn't part of libgcc. There are also some architectures on which we have libgcc, but it's not usable, for example, MIPS. So on those architectures, it can be quite a bit more painful. I have no idea what PA-RISC does in this respect. Some other architectures that haven't been ported yet, simply because I haven't gotten any response at all, have been Cirrus, what's that new, V850, those kinds of architectures. I'm sure that it will probably be done on kind of as needed basis, as far as people care. User space utilities, a lot of them have been ported. Again, no one has really taken this and kind of put it all together. So a lot of these may have been ported, but we don't really know how well they work. Most of them have been tested mostly by running them off the normal command line. This is user space code, so even though it's, you know, Caleb C code, you can still run them in a normal functioning environment. You know, you can type the Caleb C version of bin sh and get a shell prompt. Right now, all of these tools are just bundled together in one big tarball and distributed this whole thing. Again, eventually we need to get this all into the kernel build tree. And Jeff Garsick was originally going to do this. He got really busy, and Greg volunteered very graciously to work on this. So hopefully it will be done relatively soon. The last time I looked at it, what we had was kind of the infrastructure to build a basic init ramfs tarball, but not using kalypsy. And any questions? You could, certainly would be less voluminous than something like something like Super Rescue, which I don't know if anyone knows it, but it's 1.4 gigabytes worth of rescue disk. No support for C++ whatsoever. Let's put it this way. I'm sure you could link C++. You could write a program in C++ and link it against kalibc, but I'm certainly not going to support STL or anything like that. So if you write, quote, C-like C++ code, it's probably OK. What?
Yeah, I would accept that OSTL is perfectly reasonable, considering there's, you know, you haven't got the whole of the standard IRE opportunity. I was thinking more along the lines of things like exception handling. Would that cause a problem?
Yes, it will. On some platforms, you need a whole library to handle to unwind an exception, and no, we will not put that. I will not put that in kalypc.
Well, I mean, if you really want to do that, you could always
Oh yeah, absolutely. You I mean, you don't have to use kalypc just because you're using initramfs. However, it's there to keep initramfs managedly sized. But again, the person who were complaining about the 128 megabyte compressed init ramfs probably doesn't give. It varies a little bit. For example, the RPC mounty talk code probably will be a separate version, just because when you're building it for glibc, you can rely on a huge amount of RPC gen stuff, which we don't want to pull in. Other utilities, for example, other utilities, it may very well make sense to just have a common version and just do ifdef kalypc in a few places.
You still need the basic root or the MCP in the kernel, so that you can
vent
yourself with the kernel.
No.
Oh, sorry, the bootloader is doing that.
The bootloader does that, yes. And that's for purely for pure network boot, but that's firmware. That's something I have no control over. I'm sorry? Pivot root works now, and it takes a file system, or the root directory of a file system, as well as an empty directory, and takes the root and mounts it onto the specified point, and this thing becomes the new root. Because we have rootfs, we don't no longer have the issue about what to do about kernel threads. So it still changes the root on some of the user space things kind of automatically, and it's still kind of ugly. But it's a lot less ugly than the other ways you have to deal with initrd.
Is that going to be there the entirety of the
I'm sorry?
The space occupied by the data in the RAMFS, that's going to be there for all eternity?
No, that's kind of like, again, it's an open question right now, whether or not we, right now it's decompressed, or it's, de-archived onto the root FS. The root FS, it means that it's your responsibility to clean it up.
You just remove the
files, yeah. It's a RAMFS, so unlike a RAM disk, empty space doesn't actually exist. So, again, we may end up doing a separate RAMFS just to have it automatically blow away. Yes. I'm not sure I understand.
Sysret is basically it lets you reboot the machine, remount files in the kernel by just pressing Alt and the system's required key.
Oh. You know, I'm actually not sure. I would assume that it probably iterates over all the file systems regardless. And it's kind of like if it breaks anything, then it's your problem. I have no idea. No, you do not need SBin in it. You can have one if you want to, but the first process executes with PID1, and typically once you have mounted your root, your real root, and kind of change the namespace around, then you will exec SBin in it.
What does the kernel part mean in RAMFS first, like
DNA? The file name, typically SBin in it. It's just a name, right? You can specify a different name if you want to, by init equals something or other. I don't really see how you. What happens is that you get. Did everyone hear the question? The question was, what if you have these multiple CPIO archives? How do they interact? And the answer is that you end up with all the files that were in any of them. Not at this time. So I suspect a lot of this is covered by things like the file system hierarchy standard and stuff like that. The second file wins, I'm pretty sure. Oh. what we will almost certainly do is that the kernel build process will kind of build a default initramfs that behaves mostly like the current kernel does. If you want something other than that, you know, using the kernel command line and stuff like that, you can obviously customize it. You could do that, you could just append it. Right. I think it will break a lot of things if we change that. I don't think, honestly, I don't really think that it's worth it. But that's my personal opinion. Probably the way to deal with that is to deal with it in user space, and what you just have is your what you start isn't your main script. It's a small process that just sits there and waits until something tells it that, okay, now go and execute that spin init.
Can you please make it a handle?